The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dennis Powell, and Frank Muir. Round one tests their vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words right. We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is sinophobia? S-I-N-O and then phobia. Sinophobia.
Well, it's what you do, what happens when you go for a ride, a touring in a motor car with your husband, and he won't look at a map, and he won't ask the way, and he won't look at the signs, and you land up 50 miles in the opposite direction, and the word is sinophobia.
It works the other way around with wives as well.
Oh, no. I thought of it first. Alternatively, it might be hatred of the Chinese.
And you're dead right, and that's 2 marks, and it means hatred or fear of China and the Chinese.
Actually, they say that accordion playing was started by wives trying to fold road maps.
Only they got the accordion the right way up. They never do. All right, Frank now. Frank, what is an umiak? U-M-I-A-K. Umiak.
Umiak. It's like an almanac. Am I warm?
Same sort of Arctic waters as kayak.
Oh, that's a course you know. The one that you can't have and heat it too. In Arctic waters, you have a choice of two vessels. You have a kayak, in which one person sits,
yes,
and an umiak, in which a male and a female. If you think of the female sitting, who always sits in front, and the male behind, sometimes that paddle comes around a bit sharpish and there's an ooh. Well, I say the paddle, not necessarily. And it somehow got its name through that.
I'll give you one out of two, because that was a good deal of help there. Umiak is, in fact, a large skin boat used only by the women and children, and the male hunters won't be seen dead in it because they have these little kayaks. And Umiak is a great big boat which can hold wife, grandmother, and lots of children as well.
How fascinating.
Among the Eskimos. One out of two. Dennis Powell, what is a catafalque?
A catafalque is a beer, not a drinkable, not a drinkable one, not this kind, but a B-I-E-R, beer. And I seem to remember once seeing a print of the catafalque of Nelson. It was rather classy affair with a kind of drapery over it.
A catafalque is a decorated stage or showpiece for displaying the coffin, usually the open coffin so you can see the corpse, or sometimes an effigy of the chap who's dead, at a really important funeral. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what is pornocracy? P-O-R-N-O, and then C-R-A-C-Y. Pornocracy.
Well, porno was originally harlots.
Yeah.
Pornography is writing about harlots.
Okay.
But was it Lloyd George who was talking about newspaper proprietors, and he said Baldwin?
Yeah.
Yes. The noble peers of the popular press seek power without responsibility, the privilege of the harlot in every generation.
That's it, yeah.
So it's a rule either by harlots or newspaper.
You're speaking of my profession, do you mind?
Which?
Before we run into serious danger of libel, I'm going to give Dennis 2 marks. Pornocracy means virtual control of the government by prostitutes or harlots, which is supposed to have happened in the city and state of Rome at around about the 10th century AD, when things were getting a bit rough. 2 marks. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down. And I hope that the two women members will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the programme, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Anne Scott-James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, "And gentlemen in England now abed shall feel accursed." And then, Dillis Power and Frank Muir, yours is a quite different one. "There's no place like home." At the end of the programme, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Well, round two is a round of odds and ends. Two marks for correct answers. We begin again with Anne Scott-James. What do you understand, Anne, by the expression "Tom Tiddler's ground"?
Well, it was a game one used to play when one was small. Mm.
What kind of game?
You used to sort of be rather daring, dash across to the other person's territory.
Yeah.
A sort of territory snatching.
That's it. That's in origin, that's the game. And in its adult connotation?
Oh, not a word I frequently use, do you, Dennis?
No.
I'm on Tom Tiddler's ground. I think it means I'm somewhere rather rash.
Remember what the children sang or said?
I'm on Tom Tiddler's ground.
What's the next line?
Picking up gold and silver.
Yes, now, the adult connotation is?
Well, I should think it means you're trying to make money.
Mm-hmm. Tom Tiddler's ground began life as a children's game. One child is voted, or probably compelled to be, Tom Tiddler, and protects his base from other children, tries to stop them crossing the boundary, and as Anne says, what they say is, or sing, "Here we are on Tom Tiddler's ground, picking up gold and silver." And so it comes to mean a place where money can be picked up pretty easily, and where it's simple to make your fortune. Frank Muir, what's meant by the expression "to pay the debt of nature"?
Pay one's debt to nature.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's to do something, isn't it?
Well, something happens to you. You don't so much do it.
You die.
That's it.
You die.
Why?
Because something's gone wrong with your innards. The expression derives from the fact that you owe nature your life.
You owe
your life to nature.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right.
A theory.
Two marks. Dillis Power, who was Tokyo Rose?
Tokyo Rose was a rose in Tokyo who used to broadcast, I think.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
But what about?
She used to broadcast to the opposite army, which was ours and the Americans,
mm-hmm.
trying to persuade them that the war on their side was lost.
Yeah. Jolly good. By origin, she would be what, probably?
Feminine.
Yeah. Tokyo Rose is a nickname given to a woman, there were in fact a series of them, who broadcast propaganda from Japan during the last war to the American forces. And the point is that most of them were American-born Japanese girls, and therefore they spoke American fairly well. Rather sort of Lady Marlene types. Two marks. Dennis Norden, in the expression "ride a cock horse," what sort of horse is that?
I never thought of it that way. No, I mean, you mean a cock horse is a type?
Yes.
I always thought that that was ride a cock a horse, like, you know, when you wear, have your hat cocked,
that's
and
right.
You ride on one side.
Yes, that's
word.
Quite right, yeah.
So that it's any horse, but the word a cock is a hyphen.
Yes, you're right on this, Dennis, but again, on the children's side...
A hobby horse, is it?
Ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross. What? Yes.
Well, it's somebody's knee. Or
a hobby horse or a rocking horse.
That's it, and you've got them all. All right, two marks it is. Ride a cock horse. In the 16th century, a cock horse was one of these toy horses or hobby horses, and children sort of ran along the streets and got mown down by various things. But Dennis is also right in saying that cock horse is an adverb, meaning astride. But the usual way in which this was sung was when papa, or more likely grandfather or uncle, balanced the child on his foot or his knee and sang this little song about ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross to see a fine lady on a white horse, etc. Now a round of foreign expressions in fairly frequent use. Two marks, what the following mean. Anne Scott-James, mot juste.
Means you've got just the right word.
For?
Well, what you're trying to say.
Well, it might mean a word of abuse. This is it. Yes, all right. Two marks. The word that conveys a desired shade of meaning with more precision than any other word would do. Frank Muir, Au fait. A-U-F-A-I-T. Au fait.
Au fait means you are up on whatever's being discussed.
Yes, hello. Too much.
Bon, merci. Or rather, da.
Conversant with, or instructed in, or at home with, all these au fait. De l'espoir, au naturel.
Au naturel means without any admixture, just pure.
And in connection with what normally?
Well, water au naturel, or wine au naturel.
You missed out the most frequent of all.
Fish?
Mm-hmm. No.
Trout.
Au naturel means mucky sauce,
yes,
especially.
Yes, no sort of...
Au naturel means cooked in the simplest possible way, as Frank says, without any mucky sauces. One out of two.
A girl au naturel is a girl without makeup.
That's
but she needn't necessarily be pure.
I think it's more than that, Frank. It's more like Dejeuner sur l'herbe, in which she has very, very few clothes on indeed. But I may be wrong.
What a mind. Never crossed my thoughts.
All right, Dennis Norden, au pair.
Well, it's a French word for a German or Italian girl. Comes over, live as family. She's got better clothes than you have. Pigskin suitcases.
Four nights off a week.
Four nights off a week. Won't put her hands in hot water.
But by origin, it means what?
It actually means a kind of quid pro quo, that's all. A swap.
Yes, but what about the quid?
Swap. Well, you give her shelter, and you let her watch television. That's the quid.
Yes. It means, really, paid for by mutual services with no money passing, and usually means an arrangement between two parties so that it happens this side and
you just
the other side.
You just try and get one on that.
Yes, that's what I was afraid of. And now we come to the last round, and we go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the program. Two marks and Scott James. Can you give me the origin of your quotation? And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall feel accursed.
It's a part of Henry V's speech before the Battle of Agincourt. Is it not?
Absolutely right, yeah. In the play called...
Henry V.
Thank you very much. Two marks. Shakespeare, Henry V, Prince Hal's speech before the Battle of Agincourt. Now, to this power, can I have the origin of your quotation? There's no place like home.
Well, it's a very favourite song of the English. It begins, "Midst pleasures and palaces, though I may roam, mm-hmm. yet never so humble, there's no place like home."
That's it, yeah. Do you remember who wrote either the words or the music?
Well, it sounds like Mrs. Hemans, but I don't know.
No.
It's American, isn't it?
American, is it?
American.
American.
American lady or gent.
I don't know.
Well, I think they words certainly in American, song. But music, I think, this side of the Atlantic.
No, I don't know.
One and a half. Be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. It was the song of Home Sweet Home first came in an opera called Clary, the Maid of Milan. The words were by John Howard Payne, who was an American.
Ah, yeah.
And the music was by Sir Henry Bishop. And this tune, I think, was based on a Sicilian air. Well, now I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back, first of all, to Dennis Norden and to his quotation. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall feel accursed.
It was this rather embarrassing experience at the dentist that got me started on this crusade. See, I have to admit it, I'm somewhat of a physical coward. And I'm afraid when I did see him last week, I was kicking up a bit of a fuss. I kept saying, "It hurts, it hurts, don't." And he said, "Look here, unless you try and control yourself, I shall have to ask you to leave the waiting room." It's always been like that. I mean, anything to do with any dentist, I used to have to take Novocaine to make an appointment with them. And this particular one, I'm not terribly mad about as a dentist. In fact, I don't think he should ever have been given a license to practice because he has a physical disability. He has very big hands. And it's very difficult when you're a dentist with very big hands because he has to take out two of your front teeth in order to get at your back one. But it was this whole thing that got me thinking, why do we have to have dentists? I mean, we've ironed out so many things in life. And I came up with the answers because we have teeth. You know, because I don't mess about in thinking. I go, you know. And I thought, well, do we have to have teeth? You know, I mean, when you think about it, it is the only part of your body that you have to go and get serviced every 6 months. I can't think of another one. And some of the greatest advances in modern nutritional thinking, teeth absolutely won't cope with at all. I mean, you take baked jam roll. If you've got one tiny little filling, hot baked jam roll, you're on aspirin for the rest of the day. You see, so in sort of scientific terms, these bits of enameled things inside our mouth are really, sort of technologically speaking, a dead loss. You see? So one starts to think, if it's true that they haven't kept pace, as it were, with the rest of our bodies, and we're walking around with a mouthful of what is virtually outdated equipment, why don't we get rid of them? We don't need them. They must be able to think up something else. Well, they say, all right, well, then what else can you have? You see, the answer is false teeth. See, everybody laughs when you says false. False teeth are objects of derision, aren't they? Like mothers-in-law, kippers, you know, false teeth. But if it weren't for that, now one starts thinking, you see. Suppose one did a tremendous public relations job on false teeth. Made them trendy. And give them the full glamour treatment. I mean, why should they always be white? You see, if you've got Carnaby Street, for example, putting out false teeth, each one a different colour. You know, like a snooker set. So you could have tartan ones. Why not, for our Scottish listeners, tartan teeth? After all, if you have striped toothpaste, why couldn't you have striped teeth? You were sceptical at first, but you're beginning to get it now. Well, I don't see why we here tonight shouldn't get together and make this happen, because it's purely public relations, and we can do it. And we can do it, and we should do it. Not within our children's lifetimes, within our lifetimes. And not just within our lifetimes, before tomorrow. Because I've got another dentist's appointment tomorrow. So if we can get together, what we can do tonight is to take steps that can abolish the whole profession of dentistry tonight. So that dental men in England, now abed, can feel themselves accursed.
I never dare to be rude to my dentist, so I'm not going to comment. So we go on to Frank Muir's line, if you remember, which was, "There's no place like home."
Very good line, very true. I know, because I was incarcerated in my home for a few weeks recently, owing to being taken ill. Well, not ill, really. I ripped my neck twice. Both to the left and to the right. You might think this takes a bit of doing, but I was in the bookshop, the local bookshop at Virginia Water, and I really think that a law should be passed that if bookshops sell paperbacks, they should either be laid down horizontally so that you can read the titles on the spine, or if they're stood upright, all the titles should be in the same direction. Fortunately, the young fellow there was most kind, and he got a car to take me home and said, I will supply a free charge a book to help you get better, which is a teach-yourself medication. See, another thing they should do is make compulsory stronger lights in bookshops. Because when I got home, what he'd given me was Teach Yourself Meditation. And it was a book, terribly interesting book, actually, on this transcendental meditation lark of finding a fuller and cleaner and purer life, au naturel, by inward meditation. Apparently this book, this chap's an expert, he'd written it, called Topsy. Sounded rather an odd name to me, actually, but apparently it wasn't his born name, he was given it, because apparently, unlike most mystics, he wasn't brought up and educated to it from birth, this mysticism. He just glued, so they called him Topsy. But apparently there are three sorts of meditation. The first method described in the book was yogurt. Now, this is very similar to yoga, but you drink sour milk while you're doing it. And I tried this, actually. You have to sit down and then sort of sit down on the floor with your back very erect and tie your legs into a bow. You do it by sort of heaving and pulling. I got mine into position, actually. I was just hauling the last big toe across the right thigh, and suddenly there was a pain in my left hip. As though somebody had touched a red-hot soldering iron to it, a muscle had given. Well, of course, I had to send for the surgical hose and whatnot, and that method was out. Method two is contemplating the navel. You sort of bend your head and you look at your navel for a long time, and this gives us a purity of thought and mind. I found it rather unrewarding, to be quite honest. I'm not claiming that there's anything special about my navel, which is probably the trouble. I found it a dull navel, really. You know, I looked at it for about 20 minutes and removed a piece of fluff. Really found myself not a better mirror at the end of it. So I went to the third method, which is the Om method, which comes from Tibet. This magic word, Om. You have to clear your mind of all thoughts. And in the vacant chamber, which is left, you say to yourself the word Om, which is supposed to echo about as though it's a tuning fork noise. Om. And I started clearing my mind of thoughts. Really, the most extraordinary stuff came out. It was like unpacking the cupboard under the stairs. Really. And suddenly, once I got rid of all these thoughts, my mind was clear. I said, Om. And suddenly I felt in a state of euphoric bliss. It was absolutely beautiful. And now, whenever I'm worried, whenever this old world gets on top of me, I just get rid of all these thoughts and I say, Om. It's a lovely, lovely feeling. No, I was telling an Eastern friend of mine about this and said, this Om system really works. It's absolutely marvellous. You go into this trance of bliss. And he said, well, he's well known. In my family, there is a saying, we have a saying, there is no bliss like Om.
Well, by your vote, Frank Muir just wins the contest of the two stories by a single second, but nevertheless, Dennis Norden and Anne Scott-James win the entire contest by 1.5 marks, and that also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott-James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. Thank you.